From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The British philosopher Alain de Botton has become bored with the debate over religion. He says the real issue is not whether God exists, but where to take the argument once you decide he doesn't. De Botton is an atheist who's written a book for people who don't believe in a God, but who could believe there are elements in religion that could be useful and interesting. Today in the program, he's joining us to discuss some of the lessons he's trying to retrieve from religion, like how to generate feelings of community, how to promote kindness, how to rethink education and art and design. De Botton isn't interested in doctrines or dogmas. He's interested in structure and organization. Religions, he says, are great about inspiring and spreading ideas. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The British philosopher and writer Alain de Botton has been getting a lot of attention for his new book called Religion for Atheists. In it, he makes the case that it's possible to remain a committed non-believer and still find use in the good parts of religion, the parts that encourage communities and gratitude and kindness, the parts that counteract materialism or make use of art and architecture. It isn't the doctrines of religions that he's interested in. It's their structure, their organization. He wants secular institutions to adopt their teaching techniques and their rituals, even the buildings themselves. De Botton says that religions have been able to combine the theories of ethics and metaphysics with the practical concerns of life, like education and politics and fashion and art. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about his Non-Believer's Guide to the Uses of Religion. Alain de Botton is a philosopher, a writer. His books have looked at love, travel, architecture, and work. He's a co-founder of the School of Life, which is based in London and offers programs and classes in living well. And he's joining us today from the BBC in London. And Alain de Botton, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
If you don't mind, I wanted to kind of back into this discussion and start with the French sociologist Auguste Comte, which you write about, of course. And as you say in the book, you weren't the first to try and balance non-belief with religious ideas. I'm wondering, was Comte, talk about him a bit, and I'm wondering if he was an inspiration that got you started thinking about this in some way.
Absolutely. This is a really good place to start. So Auguste Comte, a really minor figure in a way, but he's kind of known among academics. But he was living in the second half of the 19th century, and he realized that people were going to church less and less. And he worried about a society where people didn't have any belief. And he said rather presciently that if people focused just on making money and achieving status on the one hand, and on personal relationships and their families on the other, and they had nothing else, then he ventured society would start to fracture apart and there would be enormous increase in mental health issues. And it was for this reason that he decided that he had to try and replace religion with something that he called the religion for humanity, which was literally a kind of stripped down version of Christianity, with himself as the what he called the great leader and his girlfriend Mathilde in the position of the Virgin Mary. It was slightly crazy, but you know, it's interesting. And it caught on for a while. Yeah. It weirdly caught on in Brazil. Brazilians really fell for this, and you can still find some Kantian communities down there in Brazil. Look, it was kind of crazy, but it points us to something, which is too often, if you say you don't believe, it's almost like that's the end of the conversation, whereas really should be the beginning. And the beginning is, okay, so how do we live well outside of belief? And I think paradoxically, Kant was onto this. Mm. He realized that many of the answers to how to live well, even as a non-believer, are to be found in religion itself.
You write about how he was denounced by atheists and believers, mocked by the newspapers, ignored by the public. I'm wondering if you're experiencing a bit of that yourself. I mean, what do you make of the reactions to your book so far?
I mean, you do get shot down from both sides.
Yeah.
you know, you get the atheists, and there's a very virulent kind of atheism at large in the world that suggests not only that religious belief is false, but also that it's dangerous and potentially evil and ridiculous. And these people have not been happy at all. I mean, I get emails on a daily basis accusing me of being a betrayer of atheism, which is just bizarre because, you know, I'm a non-believer. Yeah. But at the same time, accepting all the abuses and all the bad stuff that goes with religion and has gone with religion down the ages. Nevertheless, I make a very common sense point. It shouldn't be contentious, but boy, oh boy, can it be so. The point that I make is there's nevertheless some very, very interesting concepts and practices and rituals that accompany religion, and secular society misses out on these at its peril and should engage with them even if they choose not to believe.
Mm. You were raised in what you call a committedly atheistic household. And then you write about the fact that you underwent what you call a crisis of faithlessness. Talk about that, if you would.
That's right. I mean, my childhood was very much a kind of a later 20th century kind of childhood in Western Europe. There was no religion anywhere, not at school, not at home. And in fact, at home, my parents believed very much in science, particularly biology. They were people who believed in technology and the future. And for them, religion was just a strange, superstitious thing from a painful past, and they wanted none of it. And that's the atmosphere that I grew up in. And, you know, more and more people are growing up in that kind of atmosphere. And I suppose, in my mid-20s, lots of things happened. I read St. Augustine's City of God in a course I was doing on philosophy. And I remember thinking at the outset, well, I'm sure this is going to be very boring and very irrelevant because, after all, I'm an atheist. Yeah. And, you know, what can St. Augustine teach me? And the more I read this book, the more I was fascinated and impressed and amazed by the complexity and the relevance of these thoughts. So when St. Augustine talks about, you know, two cities, the city of God and the earthly city, it talks about the status systems of both of them, power and money in the city of men, and you know, love and charity and humility in the city of God. All these things, you know, you don't need to be a Christian for all of this to start ringing bells and to be very impressive and interesting. And, you know, then I bumped into some music by Bach, and I looked at a lot of art, Christian art in Italy. I made a trip to Japan and got interested in Zen Buddhism. And gradually I made a realization which shouldn't be common sense, which should be common sense, but wasn't for me, which is, my goodness, there's an awful lot in religion that is very, very interesting and very impressive. Mm. So I've never changed my stance on belief itself, but I've totally changed my stance on, as I say, the rituals, the practices, and the concepts that religions bring.
You talk about in the book how we have, in secular societies, really grown frightened of the word morality. Explain why you figure that's really a dicey word in a lot of societies.
It absolutely is. I mean, the question you hear more than anything, and it used to be an adolescent question, but now it's become a general question. And that question is, who are you to tell me how to live? That's anyone who tries to suggest ways of living, approaches to how to deal with things, is likely to run into that question. Who are you to tell me how to live? We have a paranoia about that, and we have an obsession with freedom. And freedom basically means I want to be left alone and no one should guide me. No one should teach me anything. I am an adult, and being an adult means not listening to anyone else about, you know, the art of living. Mm. And I couldn't disagree more. I think being an adult means being open to suggestions, and even the most robust and mature adult needs guidance, needs help. You know, life is full of crises. Most of us have them on a weekly basis for one thing over another. So I disagree with that. And when it comes to morality, I don't in any way want to suggest that religions have a monopoly on morality. It's entirely possible to be an extremely moral person outside of a religious structure. Nevertheless, religions very clearly suggest that we need help in being good. And a lot of what religions do can be seen as a support structure for our nobler impulses. All of us, in theory, believe in love and kindness and justice. But in the day-to-day heat of the action, in the office, at home, etc., we forget. And religions try in different ways, whether it's through music or through readings or through poetry or any number of techniques, to try to tug us back towards a kind of optimal, kinder, nobler self. It doesn't always work, but I think it's a fascinating ambition.
So you're not interested in the doctrines, the dogmas of religions. You're interested in the way they organize themselves, I guess, because it seems like it. Your sense of this is that religions don't want to take good ideas for granted. They want us to constantly be reminded of the ideas, and they're good at giving traction to ideas, I guess.
That's right. I mean, my thinking is that the modern world is full of great ideas, but very few of them stick. And what religion can be seen as in many ways is a training of the mind. Now, all of us accept in the modern world that going to the gym is a completely fine thing to do. You need to train your body. But we don't train our minds. We don't train ourselves systematically to be good, to be kind, to remember what matters. There are very few structures of guidance. And all religions start from the premise that life is difficult and you need to surround the individual with help. At every stage, from the moment of birth to the moment of death, you need systems, you need advice, you need echo chamber, you need things. And it's that vulnerability that sets the analysis of what human beings apart in the religious framework apart from the secular framework. And I'm very fascinated by this.
So you talk about organizations being important, the structures anyway of religion being important. And then you always get that response that it, and this is particular to Christianity, it seems, that there was some essential truth, the idea, let's say, of Christ. And then once structures were developed, once an organization came to be built around this structure, it in some way corrupted the essential idea of it. You hear that a lot in Christianity. How do you respond to that idea that in that sense an organization hasn't been good for some kind of essential truth or something?
I mean, you're absolutely right that it's become almost, one could say, fashionable to say that belief is fine, but it's religion, in particular the structure of the churches, etc., that corrupts everything.
Yeah.
As an atheist, I'd like to throw out another idea, which is basically to say that for all the abuses of institutions, and of course there are some, many maybe, institutions are nevertheless vital. Because if you think of what religions are organized bodies of people acting in concert for a common end. Mm. And that lends them enormous power. You know, in the modern world, atheists tend to believe that if you want to change the world, you act alone because joining a group would be corrupt. And maybe what you should do is, you know, write a book, and books will change everything. And I speak as an intellectual here. Mm. I don't think books do change anything. It's really very hard to change the world with a book. Of course, religions have books right at their center, but they are far more than just books. They're community centers, they're libraries, they're universities, they're schools, they're singing organizations, they're communal organizations, they have laundries and restaurants and radio stations and, you know, all sorts of things. And to think that a book can make a big difference against that is to miss out on, as it were, the virtues of organization. So I think organization has brought a lot to religions, and secular people sometimes forget all of the strength that comes from that.
The idea of community is something you get at. You write about how modern society is feeling this strong loss of the sense of community. And the question, I guess, is what you pose in the book is, you know, what happened to it or what's happening to it? And one of the theories that you get from historians, as you point out, is that we really began to lose a deeper sense of community when religion stopped being a public affair and became kind of a private matter.
That's right. I mean, the feeling is, even the most, the greatest cheerleader for non-religious society would admit that we've got a problem in the realm of community, that there was once a situation where people knew their neighbors, stuck up for each other, there were stronger communal ties. And what's happened to it is in some ways seemingly connected with the decline in religion. Now, there are all sorts of reasons why religions bring people together and create communities, some of them linked up with doctrines and particularly supernatural doctrines. Nevertheless, I want to suggest that the communal building side of religions is actually accessible to all, and atheists can learn a lot from it. I think what religions do is to bring together people on a regular basis, and they make sociability safe. You know, they close the doors, mm-hmm. and they say everybody here could potentially be a friend. There is humanity beneath the stranger. And they essentially introduce us to one another. You know, after all, the word host is a religious word. We know the term host from, you know, a party, say. You know, if a party doesn't have a good host, what happens? People sit in corners. They don't talk to each other. They grow foreign to one another. But if there's a good host, the host will introduce people and do that basic but very important task, which is to say, you could be a friend with this person. And that's what religions do. They gather people together and they make that sociability possible. People sometimes say, well, look, you know, what about Facebook and social media? Can't that do all the same stuff? You know, can't we get that elsewhere? And if you look at social media, most of it is based around grouping together people according to shared interests. So if you like, you know, Canadian ice hockey or, you know, the history of crocodiles or whatever, you know, you get together in a group and you get talking. The problem with that is that some of us don't care about crocodiles or ice hockey. We're just people. And what religions are doing at their best is slightly more ambitious, which is they gather a group of people rather randomly. And they say, even though you've got, in a way, nothing in common at the surface, the spiritual journey is to discover the humanity beneath this otherwise kind of impassive and strange surface. And that's a fascinating challenge and one that we too often don't take up in the secular world. After all, in the secular world, every day you could spend time with other people at the concert hall, at the movies, in the restaurant, at the mall. We're not short of people, there are other people around, but there are no mechanisms for turning strangers into friends. And religion's unparalleled at being able to do that. And that's fascinating to me.
You point out that in a secular age that we tend to be inclined to see community in our family. But I guess what you're saying is Christianity in particular here has a kind of more expansive view about what community means.
That's right. You know, sometimes it seems as though Christian values point primarily to the value of the family.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, there's emphasis on the family. But if you look at a lot of Christian texts, particularly early Christianity, you find a fascinating attitude towards family, sometimes even a hostility. And the hostility goes like this. If you care a lot for your family, if you focus a lot on your family, there can come a point, doesn't have to, but there can come a point when you value family over and above the family of man in general, where you retreat into a potentially rather selfish cocoon and you shut yourself off from the stranger. And as I say, in the more kind of revolutionary or slightly extreme text, you find an invitation to leave the family and, as it were, to create a new family. You know, this is what Jesus says at various points. So it's been rather suppressed, and Christianity has sometimes been just equated with family values. And though there is some of that, there's this perhaps even greater challenge, which is to discover the family of man.
So the idea is leaving behind the attachments of earthly status and focusing, as you say in the book, on the inner values, love and charity. That's what the idea
is. Yes, I mean, this is,
yeah.
I mean, this is a fascinating move that Christianity in particular makes, which is it says whenever you see a human being, there are two ways of evaluating that person. The first one you can do is to look at how powerful they are, how rich they are, how much status they have. And the second one, second question you can ask is, what is their heart like? And when we say about people, you know, what's the first question we ask about people when we're talking about them? A new person's introduced in conversation. People will say something like, what does that guy do?
Yeah.
And then maybe someone asks, well, is he nice? And that second question is a Christian question, basically. It's a question that recognizes that human value rests not just or even principally, or even primarily on earthly status, but on the quality of the heart. And this lets so much air into the conversation. We would be such a poor society if all we had was the power and status method of evaluation. Thank goodness for religions, and all religions do this in one way or another, for introducing that other criteria, which is essentially an ethical one. How good is that person's soul? That's a question we need to keep asking, whether we believe or don't believe.
You write about the Catholic Mass, for example, and one important part of the lessons, I guess, that we could take from the Mass is that the fact that the ceremony, the ritual itself, began as a meal, as a kind of communal feast.
That's right. I mean, you know, what we now know as the Eucharist started as a meal. It was a group of friends joined by the love of Jesus, breaking bread together on a weekly basis. Apparently these meals got a little out of hand. More and more people wanted to join, and it became what we now know, you know, as the Mass. It's fascinating to imagine that, particularly because food retains such a central place in our culture. But on the whole, food has been separated out from the task of sociability. And it's in many religions, in fact, all religions, you tend to find an emphasis on the way in which food can bring people together, not just, you know, to satisfy their physical hunger, but to satisfy the emotional longing for closeness and community. And religions are skillful at that, whether, as I say, it's that, you know, Eucharist meal, that original meal in Christianity, or, you know, the Jewish Friday night Sabbath meal, or whatever it may be. You see an attempt to join up the satisfaction of the body with the satisfaction of the communal impulse.
So how do you translate... How do you translate the bonding elements in a Catholic Mass then to a secular world? Because you mention, let's have a meal.
Absolutely. I mean, the standard view of atheists is either to reject religion altogether, or if pushed on this, to say something like, okay, so religions did do, you know, a few nice things, like, you know, maybe they put up some good buildings and maybe they had those nice meals and, you know, but the point is we don't believe and so, you know, that's just one of the things we've got to give up. I'm challenged in my book to say, okay, look, if we like certain things in religion, why would we as non-believers simply leave it at that? Surely the task is to use religion and say, when we like something, that's telling us something about our needs. Every time we feel envious of religion, that means that religion's got something that we don't have. And one of the ways to pay homage to the genius of religion is to say, okay, well, you know, let's see what we can learn from this. So maybe we should set up our own meals. If eating together with a stranger is such an important thing, we don't seem to ever do it. So let's try and do it. So that's one of the things I suggest in my book, along with a few other ideas. You know, some people say, oh, this is a crazy idea. How could you possibly, you know, try and recreate a Passover meal or a Eucharist supper. The point is not to recreate, but to take inspiration to take the best bits.
I wonder, you've probably seen this, certainly here in the United States. I'm wondering if it's taking place in Great Britain, but this new trend of kind of communal tables at restaurants, I don't suppose that would count.
It's a fascinating development. Yeah. I think the British are well behind on this score. Take them a few more centuries to talk to anyone else. But it's not there. But look, I think secular society is still trying to find ways to organize itself. A lot was lost when faith disappeared as the guiding principle of states, nation states. Of course, there are still religious people in countries in the United States and in Western Europe, etc. Of course, there are religious people. But if we think of countries which are run along religious lines, things get lost. Of course, things get gained, huge increase in freedom and personal autonomy, etc. Mm-hmm. But things get lost. And I think we're still trying to work out in the secular realm how to deal with certain absences. I mean, take marriage and death. We still don't properly know how to get married and how to die outside of religion. Religions still have an unbelievable power in this area because they know how to touch certain buttons. They understand us. Look, it's early days, and I think that we're probably going to learn one day. I don't see this continuing as it is forever. You know, there will probably be mechanisms that will emerge that will deal with our longings. But I think that none of this can happen unless people really focus on what religions have done at their best.
Alain de Botton is with us. His book is called Religion for Atheists, A Non-Believer's Guide to the Uses of Religion. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the popular British philosopher Alain de Botton is our guest. But de Botton doesn't believe in God. He never has. And so that's the basic assumption for the book he's written about religion. He calls the book Religion for Atheists. He believes it's possible to remain a committed non-believer and still use the good parts of religion. He's joining us to explain how you balance a rejection of faith with a kind of selective reverence for the rituals and the structures of a church. Let's go to the phones. Daniel is with us in Salt Lake. Daniel, welcome.
Yeah, Doug, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I grew up in a religious community that would pray over so many different occasions. And since leaving that faith, that's a really, there's so many elements of prayer that have seemed lost to me. You know, when you guys talked about the Mass and how that's like a time to bring people together, I've really wondered, does he have any ideas to a substitution for prayer, you know, to address yourself to something other than deity in order to get those same benefits that prayer can bring to a religious community?
Hmm. Alain de Botton?
Absolutely. It's a fascinating question, because if you look at prayer, it's sometimes understood, and I think slightly misunderstood, as a moment when believers ask God for things. Yeah. It's like a moment of petition. I think it's deeper, really. It's a moment when you look into yourself, take stock of yourself, atone, understand, yes, in the presence of God, but not necessarily asking God for anything. And that's a key insight, because if you're a non-believer, there remains the possibility of focus, of self-knowledge, of acknowledgement, of atonement, of forgiveness. These things can remain outside of a religious structure. I think part of the problem is that we struggle to find a language in which to express that kind of need. I mean, if you say to a friend, look, I'm going to the gym, or I'm going for a jog, or I'm going for a walk, people understand what you mean and why you're doing it. If you're a religious person, you say to a friend, I'm going to take a break for a moment of prayer, people understand. If you're an atheist and you say, or, you know, non-believer, and you say, I'm just going to go and focus in on myself and you know, try and collect my thoughts and I'm trying to understand myself and forgive others and, you know, etc. People would think, my goodness, this sounds a little bit strange. What is this person doing? In other words, we don't have a respectable structure in which to do this very important stuff. And so I think what we non-believers need, above all, is a language in which to describe our needs and a confidence to define those needs so that they can become social needs, and so that it would be no stranger to say, I'm going off for a moment of, you know, self-reflection and self-focus, than it would be to say, I'm going off to have a bath. That these things are just, you know, things that people do. And at the moment, we're still at that kind of intermediate stage, where, as I say, non-believers are kind of excluded from a very rich and interesting ritual that that believers have worked out.
Daniel, thanks for the call. Here's an email from Ross, who is writing about motivation. He says, for the religious, being good to others is an investment. A religious person, he writes, may protest that there are no guarantees that a proper motivation for goodness is the joy found in pleasing our Creator. But he says, I suspect that one of the sources for that joy is the hope that by being good to others, one will reap divine rewards. Is there a secular motivation for going out of one's way for a person who isn't likely able to return the favor and that has the same force or the same appeal as this hope for divine benevolence?
I think there absolutely is. I mean, there are two common ways in which motivation is understood in religion. One is you'll get some divine reward, and two is if you aren't good, you'll be punished. I think these are kind of slightly lower grade motivations. The much more ambitious motivation, much better, more interesting motivation, is to say, if you are good, you're living up to what you actually are, because you were made by a divine force and goodness is divine. And in other words, you should live up to the divine part of you. And when you do, you'll feel good about it, because you'll realize that you are acting in accordance with your deepest, best self. Now, strip away the doctrine, strip away the belief in God, and the argument is actually just the same, which is when we are good, we're living up to our best possibilities, and we feel good about being good. You know, when we lose our tempers, when we're nasty, when we're, you know, forgetful, etc., when we hurt people's feelings, very few of us feel proud. All of us kind of feel bad in our heart of hearts if we're really honest with ourselves. But the problem is we don't have the strength to do anything better. And I think, you know, the best thing to do is to remind people not of what some figure in the sky with a beard wants them to do, but to remind them of what they would want to do if they were acting rationally, calmly, and with their best self, you know, in evidence. So it's not about doing something you don't want to do. goodness should be about honoring what you really, really want to do when you are, when you're calm, when you're relaxed, when you're, you know, when you're thinking straight. And most of the time we're not calm. But, you know, I think all of us have a longing for goodness, which we can't honor day to day, but it's there.
Let's go back to the phones. David is with us in Salt Lake. David, hi.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for having me on, Doug.
Sure.
Mr. Dibaton, are you familiar with Gurdjieff?
I'm not.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'll just make a quick comment. Yeah. He was a mystic early to mid-20th century, and he sort of practiced an idea that the day-to-day, somewhat dreary repetition of religious practices sort of turns us into automatons. And he taught these ideas of the everyday, every moment ritual, such as you're talking about, like eating or cleaning or repairing a car. We had to focus on them in order to sort of keep us re-energized all the time instead of sort of just zoning out. And I'm wondering where you might place that in the spectrum of your discussion, and I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks.
That sounds really interesting. I think one of the things we're sorely lacking in modern society is structure. Things come at us very randomly. You know, you switch on the news, there's sort of 80 stories that are completely disconnected and just tipping out at us, and we can't really make sense of them. What religions are very good at doing is connecting big ideas to the calendar. They say, you know, every Monday do this, every Tuesday do that, you know, every month is about one thing or another. They structure time for us. The secular world leaves time unstructured, thinking that that's an interruption of our freedom to direct us to certain thoughts. I think we desperately need calendars. We really need structures. We need moments of the week, of the day, when our thoughts are invited in a particular direction by some external agency rather than simply left to their own devices. I think this pushes us in the right directions, in optimal directions.
You know, this idea of being, you know, this being an interruption of our freedom comes up from time to time in the book. I mean, you write a section, for example, about kindness. And how in politics, for example, the left and the right is dominated by this libertarian ideology that it's not the government's job to say how we should act towards one another, that we're seldom encouraged as adults, you say, to be nice to each other.
Yes. I mean, I think we're really confused about advice and about encouragement in one way or another. The dominant view, particularly kind of intellectuals, university people, they're really resistant to the notion of advice, of any voices in the public square directing people. There's a kind of an idea that the public square should be empty and people should be just following their own impulses, not being guided by the government or by church or anything in particular. Now, of course, governments and churches, etc., can abuse freedom a lot. But my prime answer is to say, listen, we don't have a neutral public square anyway. We are living in what we can call a commercial society. That means that we are bombarded every second of the day with ideology, with commercial messages, with recommendations to buy this, to do that, to esteem the other. We are not living in a neutral space. And it's paradoxical that even though it's not neutral anyway, some of the people with the best ideas will retreat and say, oh, it's not for me to influence anyone. I don't want to speak about these things because they may, you know, it may be bossy or, you know, it may influence people in too forcibly, etc. So kind of the intellectuals, the artists, etc., they've kind of left the field worried about influence, leaving the massive engines of commercial influence to rule the field. And that seems bizarre, a kind of abdication of responsibility, because of course we need to be reminded of things that we like and that we believe in. We don't need to be persuaded of things we don't believe in, but we do need to be reminded of you know, kindness and generosity. I mean, think of something like Christmas, right? Think of the Christmas holidays. What is the ritual of Christmas? The ritual of Christmas is a celebration and a reminder of the importance of kindness, right? That's what it is. Is that such a bad thing? No. I mean, as a non-believer, I think, oh, that's good, because around Christmas time, for around 2 weeks, people are a bit nicer to one another. Of course, people still could lose their temper and fire one another and act meanly. But weirdly, there's a kind of decline in meanness around that time of year. And that's because religion has created a moral atmosphere. And a moral atmosphere is simply an atmosphere in which evil and bad deeds seem a bit more incongruous than they do the rest of the year. And I say, you know, great, let's bring on a little bit more moral atmosphere. I don't see any problem with that. Difference between moralistic and moral, but, you know, that's to explore another time.
Right. Let's take another call before we head to a break. Michael is with us calling from Utah County here in Utah. Michael, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question for you. Here in Utah County, obviously the predominant religion here is Mormonism. You're going to get upwards, you know, 85-90%. With that, there are also several ex-Mormons. And I've noticed a trend of, you know, many ex-Mormons simply lose faith altogether, you know, become agnostic or atheist. And it's very fascinating because many of us have connected, you know, via message boards on the internet or Facebook. And that's usually not enough. You'll find many, you know, lunches or dinners that are advertised or, you know.
Did we lose you?
Oh, I think we might have lost him.
I think I can
sort of guess where he was headed.
Yeah, yeah. They're looking for a gathering place, I guess, right?
That's right. I mean, you know, it's interesting. Let me just be a little bit autobiographical here. But when I came to the States to talk about this book, I remember my publisher said, well, you know, we won't be sending you to Utah. They won't have any interest for your book there. And he gave out a little sort of wry chuckle from his New York office. And then the funny thing happened, which is that sales in Utah were about 8 times higher than in any other state in the union.
Wow.
And what's going on there? And I only gradually pieced it together, which is there are a lot of ex-Mormons. And what ex-Mormons are looking for is all the stuff that I've been talking about. In other words, not the doctrines, but the structure, the life, the moments that punctuate, you know, secular life and try and give it meaning, etc. All of that stuff. And so I think your caller was onto this, which is that ex-Mormons might have much more of a hunger for the organizational and, you know, aesthetic side of religion than one might think. And that they're maybe struggling to find alternatives and replacements. And I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, I wish them well on that question. That's what my book is thinking around. It's an attempt to look at that question.
Well, maybe groups like ex-Mormons or ex-Catholics or ex-whatever, maybe that's one of the places where the practical aspects of your book may manifest itself, I wonder.
Yes. I mean, because many religious people, you know, many who are nominally religious have come forward and said to me things like, look, if I'm really, really honest, I don't probe too deeply into the doctrinal stuff anymore.
Yeah.
I'm still a very committed member of my church and of the church community. But I do this because, well, of other reasons. And they're almost embarrassed. They almost don't quite know how to say it. But, you know, I'm sensing in them a kind of ambivalence and a deep attachment to what I could call the secondary parts of religion as opposed to the primary. And I think that's absolutely fine and needs to be recognized as a kind of attitude to religion.
Alain de Botton is with us. His book is called Religion for Atheists, A Non-Believer's Guide to the Uses of Religion. He's joining us from the BBC in London. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. David, Michael, thank you very much for your calls. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Alain de Botton. We're talking about his book, Religion for Atheists, A Non-Believer's Guide to the Uses of Religion. I wanted to ask you about education. You spent some time talking about education in the book. Secular society, you mentioned, has this kind of fervent belief, you say, in education. But you mentioned how it's not often clear about how modern secular education is supposed to turn students towards you know, generosity and truth, and away from, as you put it in the book, is away from sin and error. Talk about education, how it plays out in all of this.
Well, it's interesting because, society in the States and elsewhere really believes in education. At one level, that's because it's all about acquiring skills and keeping the economy competitive and finding jobs, etc. But there's another deeper, if you like, more romantic idea of what education is for, and that is to make us fully human, to make us wise, to make us adults, to make us mature. And you hear a lot about this at commencement addresses, graduation ceremonies, etc. It's the more ambitious side of what education is for. And that side started in the 19th century. That attitude towards education started, very interestingly, at precisely the time when religious belief started to go into decline, first in Britain, then across Western Europe, then in parts of the United States. And the more religion went into retreat, the more people started putting their faith in culture.
Yeah.
So you get the founding of new colleges, a real emphasis on the classics, the humanities, literature and art. All this starts to matter a lot more. And so you get a mid-19th century reformer like Matthew Arnold, who famously says that culture can replace scripture. And there's a fascinating idea. I actually think that's true. I mean, I think a lot of what people get from religious texts, you can get from Shakespeare and Plato and Aristotle and Montaigne and Jane Austen. There's a lot of consolation, ethics, guidance, truth in all of these sources. But the problem is the way it's taught. I mean, if you showed up at an average college and you said, I've come here to study to learn how to live, to find meaning, to separate right from wrong, to live well and then to die calmly. This would seem so weird. I mean, they would be dialing up the number of the insane asylum. I mean, they wouldn't let you in. It just sounds too intense, too heavy. It's almost as though the secular world believes that the business of life is kind of easy to get through. All you need to do is find a job, raise a family, deal with mortality in your friends and family and then in yourself. And, it's no big deal. Whereas religions think, no, it's really complicated. We need some help. So they accept the need for guidance. And yet the secular education system doesn't. And that explains the coolness with which the material of the humanities tends to be taught. It doesn't get taught as a tool to know how to live. Think of the word self-help. The dominant assumption in elite culture is that the people who read self-help books are stupid.
Yeah.
Other people know how to live. It's like, it's not such a big deal. Everybody knows how to live. It's just silly people who don't. And I passionately think that's wrong. Of course we don't know how to live. And we need self-help, not the kind of self-help you find, the worst examples of it, but the best examples, which are, Shakespeare and Proust and Plato. We need all this stuff, and yet it's not frequently taught in that way. So I think the educational establishment really needs to look at what religions are doing it and why they're doing it and why people are attracted to it.
You talk about even reworking the names of particular departments, human relationships, you say, rather than literature, or loving and dying, rather than something like anthropology, for example.
Well, that's right, because if you think of the way that religions divide up knowledge, think of the way they deliver sermons. They are sermons on particular questions, how to live, how to die, how to conduct friendship, how to approach the question of charity, of work, of obligations to parents, whatever it is. If you think of the way that the secular world arranges knowledge, it's like literature, history, sociology. These are not the headings that have anything to do with the human inner self. They're external academic categories. And I argue that really what we need to do is to rearrange knowledge so as to put the dilemmas of the individual soul at the forefront. So you study how to die, how to conduct a marriage, how to achieve resilience, how to forgive. These are the questions we need, into which we can feed in the fantastic knowledge from the humanities, from literature, from psychology, etc., etc. But let's not put those on the lid.
Yeah.
Let's keep the dilemmas of the individual soul at the forefront, as religions do.
You've talked about how this idea that religions kind of start with the concept that we're all children, which can be kind of offensive, as you say, to some non-believers. But you don't mind the comparison. You actually think that's kind of an important dynamic.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's just a part of being a proper functioning adult to realize that there's a lot of us that is very immature, that is childish, and we have to learn how to deal with it. We need to encase it within, you know, measures. We need to take measures to deal with it, but we can't deny it. And there's a certain kind of militant atheism that I think is overly rational. And it starts from the assumption that humans are well able to conduct their lives and that reason is a powerful tool that can get on top of everything. And I think that's just untrue to experience. Probably the discipline which most accurately captures something that religions know about us is psychoanalysis. And psychoanalysis tells us that there's the child inside every adult, and you have to learn about that child. And religions in a different way, if you like, in a more poetic way, are also alive to that. So it's that vulnerability, it's that need, those primitive needs, which are honoured within religion, but sometimes denied within a secular framework.
Jeff is with us in Bountiful, Utah. Jeff, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just had a quick question. Supposing you have a disbeliever who wants to stay with the community with the ritual because of the family or for the goodness or for the job or for the service or for the, you know, the knowledge that can be gained by that participation, how does that person deal with the issue of honesty and being upfront and open with the rest of the community?
What do you mean? Well, like, do you mean whether they should share that they're not believers, even though they're sitting amongst you in the congregation or something?
Yes, in our community, for example, we have a lot of closet doubters and people who want to stay for whatever reason. And obviously, there are very good reasons for staying with Mormonism, but they have the issue of, you know, how upfront and open should I be about this?
This has become a bit of a gathering place for Mormon doubt, eh, Alan Patton?
Yeah. Look, I think it's never a good situation when the community creates incentives to lie. I think the community should have room within itself to admit to difficult truths, to awkward truths, which don't require people to lie. So in other words, if there's somebody lying about things in a community, the whole community needs to look inside itself and go, why are we forcing people, quite nice people, quite good people, to lie? That can't be right. So I think it's a matter for the whole community. I think the anxiety around doubters is sometimes misplaced because people don't understand what it would mean. What would it mean to have a doubter? One imagines that it would mean someone who hated religion, who wanted to smash it all apart, who had no time for anything, who wanted to leave continuously. But I think, and this is what my book tries to articulate, that there are ways of being a non-believer that means that one can still, in many areas, be a friend of religion. A friend doesn't mean that you agree with everything, but it means that you are tolerant and interested and ready to put in the effort. So I think it's the image of the doubter that is causing difficulty here.
Susanna is with us in Salt Lake City. Susanna, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment, my husband and I are atheists, and whenever we get into conversations with our friends, neighbors, colleagues, where they ask us how we can be good people if we aren't believers, I'm always so shocked. These are good people asking me and my husband these questions, and yet they don't have the self-confidence to believe in themselves that they would make good decisions, be kind to other people if they didn't fear the wrath of God.
Yes, I mean, I think this is a really distressing thing. I think it's a particularly American phenomenon. In America, there's this idea that to be an atheist is to be immoral, is to lack morality. And this absolutely is an error. After all, where does most of Christian morality comes from? It comes from the ancient Greek philosophers. It comes from Plato. I mean, Plato is the moral bedrock of Christianity. So, of course, you can be a pagan, a non-believer, and have an ethical structure. Goodness does not begin or end with religion. Religions have been very powerful forces of moral instruction. They've evoked the importance of goodness, but they have not invented goodness. Goodness and morality are goods that belong with, you know, to all people. and there are potential possibilities for absolutely everyone on earth. And I think that non-believers should take that argument out to religious people and remind them of this. Morality does not depend on belief.
There's something you wrote about, you know, there's this idea, maybe it's an American notion as well, that you can't be a cafeteria Catholic or Mormon or whatever it might be. You shouldn't be able to pick and choose. But you've said that for somebody who has no religious belief, it's no more of a crime to, as you put it, dip into a number of faiths than it is for a lover of literature to single out a handful of favorite writers from across the canon. It's fine to pick and choose the things that work for you, I guess.
I know that seems potentially insulting to believers, but I think if you're a non-believer, you can look at religions as the gift of all of humanity, and you can find in different religions particularly elaborate examples and good examples of certain attitudes. So, you know, if you really want to understand desire, the hold that desire has on the human heart, you know, go to Buddhism. I mean, the Buddhists are really good on this. They understand it, they psychologize it, they create structures around it. If you're trying to understand guilt, it's the Catholics who are very good on this. If you want to understand atonement, look into Judaism. You know, all faiths and all denominations tend to have an area of strength. And it's by reading widely and taking an interest in many different faiths that one will enrich one's kind of knowledge of the human spirit. So absolutely, we have almost a responsibility to go around religions and pick out different things.
Alain de Botton, he's the author of the book Religion for Atheists, A Non-Believer's Guide to the Uses of Religion. And he joined us today from the BBC in London. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.